That's okay, no problem.
That's me, not you.
I wasn't prepared to.
What do you want? Come and get your chair.
Just sound like the surprise.
Oh, boy.
Shoving things at you, Ryan. Yeah, that'd be great, thank you.
I'm gonna record too.
Oh, wow. Sorry, the mic, there we go, thank you.
No pictures.
That's extra.
I feel like over the years, I may have thought, boy, I'd like to see Ryan Gosling do an action movie, but I wonder what kind of action movie he'd want to do. And then I saw Drive and thought, yeah, this is the kind of action movie Ryan Gosling would do. Was it a genre you were interested in or had trepidations about?
Well, you know, okay, I've always wanted to see a violent John Hughes movie. And I always thought if Pretty in Pink had a head smashing, it would be perfect. So there's that. And then on top of that, when I was a little kid, when I first saw First Blood, it put a spell on me, and I thought I was Rambo. And so I even thought my face felt like Sylvester Stallone's face when I touched it. And then I went to school the next day. I put steak knives in my Fisher Price Houdini kit, and I took them and I threw them at all the kids at recess, and I got suspended, which rightfully so. And I'm sorry, and I learned my lesson, and I never did anything like that again. But my parents said, "Look, this guy can't watch movies, you know, or violent movies, anyways." So they put me on a leash, and I could only watch, you know, Bible movies and National Geographic movies, which are very violent.
Eating animals.
And like black and white comedies and stuff like that, Abbott and Costello movies and all that. So I understand the effect that movies can have on you and the kind of spell that they can cast on you. And when I first read this script, I felt like, well, this is a guy that's just seen too many movies. He's going around acting like he's the hero of his own action movie. And I wanted to, thank you very much, I wanted to explore that idea, because I've been wanting to play a superhero, but all the good ones are taken. And I thought, well, I could create my own, potentially. And so that's what we tried to do with Drive. A violent John Hughes movie meets a guy who's confusing his own movie, his own life for a movie.
God, what do you think the kids you see Drive are going to bring to school?
A hammer?
We won't be able to use the audio if you guys talk. So please stop laughing. Stop laughing on that.
Yeah, don't have a good time. That's all I have.
Don't have a good time.
Let's have a terrible time.
You're not funny, we won't laugh.
You're funny.
But what do you think the kids you see Drive are going to want to bring to school?
Because you don't want the people hearing it thinking that we were having fun while we were doing this.
That's my thing.
Right, yeah. Okay. Good. What's that?
I was just following up. This kid who sneaks into Drive, how do you see it influencing them? What might he bring to school?
I guess a hammer. I hope he doesn't. Don't bring a hammer to school. Take it from me. It's a bad idea.
What is it like to do like that? I guess I'm thinking about the elevator scene. Like, I can't stop thinking about the elevator scene in a way. Like, what are you going through when you're acting like that, you know, and it's so visceral? Is it like, are you just so, you know, into the emotions of the character? Or does it ever hit you like, dude, I'm smashing in a guy's skull?
Well, when you're doing it, it's different because, like, we didn't have a lot of money on this movie. And look, okay, so Irreversible has a head smashing in it, which is the best head smashing that I've ever seen. And so we called Gaspar Noé and we asked him, first of all, can we do a head smashing? And second of all, how did you do that? So he told us how. But we didn't have the money that they had to do it, so we basically made these prosthetic heads to smash that didn't look anything like the guy, and they were squashed like grapes just with one kick, you know? So it was almost like Who Framed Roger Rabbit or something. It was like cartoonish, you know? So it didn't really, when you're shooting it, it has a completely different, you know, it's you're very aware of the falseness of it, you know? So it's different. It's not like it's harder to get lost in those kind of things because they're so technical. But I think that Nicholas did a great job of eliminating all of those elements and making it a really visceral and scary, transformative scene for the character. And you know, also we use like a werewolf metaphor throughout the movie, that the driver thought he was a werewolf and had never turned into one, but was convinced that he had the potential to. And in that scene, the werewolf is unleashed.
Stuff about the seeing too many movies, I haven't read the book, but is that in the book about the character, or is that something you brought to it?
Yeah, no, that's not in the book. I mean, the book, he loves movies, and he's always quoting movies, and he works, he's a stunt guy, and so he's been working on them forever, and he's a big movie buff. Mm. He liked to read scripts as well. He had a writer friend in the book who would give him scripts to read. Trying to justify, like, how would somebody go around actually doing this, you know? And we thought, well, you know, only someone who saw too many movies would do this. And the fact that he was a stunt driver kind of allowed us to explore that, because movies were a part of his life.
Yeah. What kind of movies do you think he liked? Maybe like Alan Dulles?
She hasn't asked a question yet, but she's been trying.
I try. Do you think there's a significance to the fact that the character doesn't have a name, and that he is sort of like this anonymous person that just, you know, kind of in society out there, you know, just waiting to go off? Or what do you take away from that, from the fact that he's just...
Nameless?
Yeah.
Well, we also wanted the film to feel like a fairy tale, and that Los Angeles is, in a way, a fairy tale land, based and built on fantasy. And that the only way this movie was really going to resonate on a deep level for the audience, if you weren't from Los Angeles, is if we dug into the mythology of this, these characters and this story. So we started to treat the driver as a knight and Irene as a princess locked in the tower, and Bernie Rose as an evil wizard, and Ron Perlman as the dragon that needs to be slain. And dialogue just wasn't necessary anymore. In some ways, if you eliminated the dialogue, people are smart, they can see how someone's feeling, you don't need to tell them. And we just took away everything that wasn't necessary, and it turned out that there wasn't a lot that was necessary. Very little had to be said in order to push the story forward.
Can you talk about acting without dialogue, and is that a fun thing to kind of dive into and kind of have to express without saying much?
I think you can say more that way, and once you put a word to it, it just pins it and makes it that. But so for us, we were able to say a lot more by cutting out the dialogue.
You have a really great Steve McQueen, kind of Ryan O'Neill persona in this. Did you grow up, you know, loving Steve McQueen movies? And it also has this film noir look to it, which is great.
Mm.
And, you know, this could be like a Steve McQueen film noir.
Mm.
This is how great this movie is.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
We've been calling it film neo-noir.
Okay.
Or film neon-noir, you know. But, Steve McQueen, you know, just don't try and be like him. You'll fail. Ryan O'Neill, he was great in The Driver. He's a great actor. We love those films, and obviously this movie is heavily inspired by all of those genres. But the films that we talked about the most were John Hughes movies, and the thing that really influenced the movie the most was the way that we made it, and the way that it came about. You know, I had had these feelings that, you know, I like driving, but I don't necessarily need to drive fast or do stunts, or I don't like that in movies necessarily. I just like getting in the car and driving around because I feel like it puts me under some kind of spell. I don't remember when I get somewhere, I don't remember the drive. And I, you know, like to listen to music and when I'm driving. And so I had this feeling like the movie could be about driving, not about stunts and going fast. when I met with Nicholas, you know, I don't know if you know this story, I'm sure you do, but we had a terrible first meeting, and it was like a terrible first date. And he didn't talk to me or look at me. He was totally disinterested in being there, and or at least it seemed that way to me. In retrospect, I learned that he was high on American cold medication. But he, I was like one of those dates where, like, you know, you're not going to get any action, so you just say, like, let's call it, you know, get the check. He needs a ride home now because he doesn't drive. I'm like, how could this guy make a movie about driving? He doesn't even drive. And I have to take him home, and we're in the car, and it's awful, and we're not talking, so I turn on the radio, and REO Speedwagon comes on. I can't fight this feeling anymore, and suddenly the guy comes to life. He starts crying and singing at the top of his lungs. And he says, this is it. It's a movie about a guy who drives around listening to music, which is how I'd been feeling, so I knew that that we were on to something. But what I love about the film is that the movie never would have been made if REO Speedwagon hadn't come on the radio. And the movie kept going in that direction, and that we would drive around all night, go to the 101 diner, talk, we'd drive around and listen to music, we'd edit the film, and then we'd go to work in the morning and shoot it. And then when we were done shooting, we'd go back to driving around and listening to music and editing it at night and watching movies. And so the experience of making the film, watching the film is a good representation of what the experience of making it was like.
Can you talk about what Nicholas is...
Do you
want to
go, Greg?
You go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he was next.
Can you talk about what Nicholas's greatest strengths as a director is? He's very highly stylized, and it seems he really loves American cinema.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, ever since Nicholas was a little boy, his mother's been telling him he's a genius. And everything he did was genius. Even when he was watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre while he ate his cereal before he went to elementary school every morning, obsessively, she believed that he was a genius. And I think that you get told that enough that eventually it becomes true. I'm not sure that he really started out as one, but I do believe that he's become one. And he is just very unfiltered filmmaker. He just makes what he wants to see. And he, if it's boring to him, he won't shoot it. And he fetishizes things in a way, you know, like he's married and can't kind of, you know, and so he is like this, a lot of, you know, he sexualizes things, you know, because he maybe can't be as sexual as he'd want to be, you know, so this, he talks about filmmaking a lot like having sex, and it has to arouse him, and it has to be sexually interesting to him, even if it's a pair of gloves, or it's where, you know, your hand is in the frame. It has to literally turn him on. And so that's unique. Okay. And so his films are unique.
Okay. I can follow up on your comment about this is a fable. There's quite a few references to the fable of the scorpion. Do you think that given those references that this is a guy who is inherently kind of tied to chaos, and that he can't make a better life for himself despite the fact that he might want one?
I think that... Do I think that he wants a better life?
Well, do you think it's in his nature to be in situations of chaos, whether or not he wants it?
I think that he's a psychopath. And he's, delusional, and believes that he has this darkness and rage in him that is inevitably going to come out, and he's trying to focus it into something heroic before he becomes a villain.
Yeah, that comes through in one scene specifically when you're when it's in the elevator and you've just smashed that, and Carey Mulligan looks at you. And it's almost like you have this moment of awareness of what this monster inside you, who, you know, and it suddenly becomes an obvious thing, like it's out of your fantasy world and it's into reality because she's seeing it for the first time.
Right.
That's what you mean, right?
Yeah, that's what we were, that's right.
How do you,
cool. What she said.
Yeah, no.
How do you feel about all the buzz around your performance? Is it easy to, like, you know, keep your feet on the ground when everybody's saying, he deserves the Oscar, and this is going to make it all the way to the end of the season? And, you know, how do you cope with praise like that?
You know, I just... I don't know what to say. I don't know.
You feel good about it, though? You must feel good.
Well, it's just, you know, all that stuff, it's, you know, what's difficult about praise is that when you get into this, most people tell you that it's not possible or that you can't do it. You know, nobody believes in you when you're starting out, but for a few people. And those people, you know, you learn not to care or listen to what people think, because if you did, you would be too afraid to try. So you train yourself and numb yourself to other people's opinions, not because you value your own so much or you think they're better than anyone else, but because if you really listened to other people, you wouldn't do anything. You'd be too afraid to try it. And then suddenly people decide that they like what you're doing, and then they want to praise you, and suddenly you're supposed to start caring again, you know? But if you do, you just you're still taking the same risk, and it kind of, in some way, if you start caring about what they think, it cheapens the people who did believe in you, your relationship to the people who did believe in you when nobody else did.
So interesting.
Do you think that maybe I've been catching up on your films, and you certainly can't be accused of repeating yourself, which is a good thing. And
thanks.
And it's almost like, you know, but it's sort of, I was thinking, I got this glib line in my head. Alec Guinness in a Tommy Kirk package, you know. and, you know, do you think that maybe the way that people kind of maybe are almost discouraging you from acting too much because you're good-looking and normal-looking?
People discouraging from acting too much? What do you mean?
In other words, they'd rather you act like a movie star and kind of be the same from film to film as opposed to really changing from every film the way you
playing
do.
Characters.
Different, you know, very distinct characters in each film.
Right. Well, I'm not that good looking. I'm a pretty weird looking guy, and I know that, you know, you know, but that's the magic of movies, is that once you, if you play somebody who's like, who's the romantic lead, you know, they cast that spell and people believe that about you, but it's not true. I mean, every role I ever got up until I played The Notebook was the weirdo, freak, psychopath, nerd, you know, outsider character guy, you know. And, you know, I was playing neo-Nazis, right, and, like, gay football players and doing a bunch of, you know, weird kids TV.
And by the way, I got to compliment you. I think The Believer is the most Jewish. I'm Jewish, and it's the most Jewish movie I've ever seen.
Oh, cool.
And I just think that performance was just, you know, completely knocked my socks off.
Yeah, I got gift wrapped a career with that movie.
Sure. So the just really quickly, the John Hughes thing, is that because of John Hughes movies are so romantic and so, I don't know, kind of pop music-y romantic? Is that why you guys were so with the John Hughes? I'm just trying to find, because I know that Drive is an incredibly romantic movie. It really is. It's one of the, you know, most romantic movies I've seen all year. But I'm just wondering if that was the way in with John Hughes.
Yeah, that this character was, if you're going to risk it all for this woman that you've held hands with, had to be just a hyper romantic guy who bought into those, like, romantic film fantasies of being a hero and rescuing the damsel in distress. And you know, and you know, could only feel by listening to pop music, you know. Like, you needed to put on REO Speedwagon if you wanted to cry, you know? And John Hughes movies are just, they're just champagne and cotton candy. It's just, you know, no one did that better than him. But maybe there's not a lot of contrast in his films, or like maybe a balance. It's all that. So we thought if we could throw some blood on that cotton candy.
Great.
With the Ides of March, what kind of spell does a political movie?
Well, I don't think, I mean, we were actually going for a film that could put you in a trance with Drive, you know. With Ides, it's I don't think it's I think it's a very, very different film, you know. And I don't know what kind of spell it puts you under.
I just like that description you had.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks.
You just talk about what music I listen to these days? Or you like?
Well, I love the music in this film. I'm really excited. I think it's exciting to have a good soundtrack. You know, I used to love to buy soundtracks, and I kind of stopped a while ago. But I think this is a lot of really great bands are on here. Kavinsky and Johnny Jewel, who is he has Glass Candy and the Chromatics and Mirage, and this whole dark disco thing that they're doing is I'm really into it.
Are we ever gonna hear any of your music in the soundtrack?
I don't think that would be weird. What do you think? Kind of take you out of the movie.
That'd be weird.
Oh, come on.
Thank you so much.
Oh, wow.
It's a notebook.
Brett is very proud of that notebook. Wow, it's a notebook. Who signed this?
That's Nicholas Sparks.
No way.
Okay.
So do you think you might have some effect on the election with the Ides of March coming out and the subject matter?
That's a heavy question.
I hope not.
I hope not. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Bob Tunnell says hi.
Oh, Bob Tunnell.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he and I used to work together in the 80s. We did a lot of low-budget movies.
That's my first movie.
Yeah, Frankenstein and Me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and you got to work with Bert.
I took that Frankenstein home.
No way.
Yeah, we used to get in the costume and run around.
That was a great costume. Yeah. Thanks, man. Thank you so much.
Okay, time to race to Santa Monica.
You gonna make it?
I hope so.
Good luck.
Thanks.